So it's the 5th of April, 2021. The half moon Wan Prat, the lunar observance day. Time keeps passing, and it doesn't stop. It's always passing. And then there's a shift of modes, a shift of seasons, as it's always been and always will be. And everything's just constantly in motion, constantly changing. And people from the winter retreat crew are starting to disperse. People will start leaving, going back to different scenes that they might have in other places. So there's this idea of coming apart, coming together, and then there's parting. It's like all coming together ends in parting. And everything that's fabricated ends up breaking up. Everything that's born ends up dying. Everything that arises ends up ceasing. That's just the truth that we're trying to realize. That's the truth of anicca. That's what we call anicca. So there's that, on one level we see that everything that comes together breaks up in the end. Everything that is born ages and dies. Every human being that's born ages and dies. There's no exceptions. And then there's also a more profound level to anicca, where every arising is simultaneously a passing away of something else. So there's that flux, that constant flux, and it's happening every moment. And so there's the momentary level of anicca. And you could even think of it as like with the physical world, they talk about quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, they say that the Newton's laws don't apply anymore when you get them down to the quantum level. But that's not how it is with anicca. Anicca is the same on the quantum level and also on the bigger scale. It's all the same. It's all anicca. Anicca describes the minute and it describes the big. It describes everything in the conditioned realm. And so with this contemplation of anicca, then things happening now, world events, etc., that we take as being very heavy and burdensome, then those become like nothing, because we see that it's just a blip on the screen in samsara. It's just a flash of lightning, a bubble of foam floating on water, and it's, in the big scheme of things, it's nothing. It's just more arising and passing away. So that can be liberating to have those kind of thoughts, those kind of contemplations. It can help to give us more of a sense of ease, well-being, if things start to become very heavy. So that's what we're here for. That's the key to liberation, the anicca, that contemplation of anicca. And that's what the sotapanna, the stream enterer, realizes is anicca. That's the insight that all that arises passes away. But there's that firm insight deep in the heart. It's not just an intellectual piece of knowledge or an intellectual insight. It's something that once it's seen, then one lives by it, and it it dictates every action, and the thoughts change, the moods change. It's not a small thing. It's something that's that kind of insight into anicca is something that's transformative, and it's leading to the ending of dukkha. So that's very, very important. And then the Buddha also talked about a very special type of anicca, so that's the Four Noble Truths, which describes the arising and passing away of dukkha. So that was the Buddha's specialty, and that's the insight peculiar to Buddhas, is the Four Noble Truths, and that describes and shows the process of the arising and passing away of dukkha, why it arises and how it passes away without remainder through the Noble Eightfold Path, through the cultivation of the path. And the Buddha had other insights as well. So we got at some of the last readings of the winter retreat. The Buddha alludes to other things, other knowledges he had. He tells Ananda about the eight causes of earthquakes, for example, and he gets into things that sound pretty similar to plate tectonics and why earthquakes happen. And then also saying earthquakes happen because of a Buddha's enlightenment and so on. So he alludes to other kinds of insights that he had, like being able to know why earthquakes arise. But what was peculiar to the Buddhas is the Four Noble Truths, Noble Eightfold Path. It's also interesting that the Buddha is so ordinary. He's not really lifting up and pointing to things like incredible psychic powers or miracles. So he detracts from that. He comes back to the ordinary, which is interesting. Ordinary things like feeling, like just looking at feeling, just pleasant, painful, neither painful nor pleasant. So looking at those feelings and then the default reactions to those feelings. So when there's unpleasant feeling, the default is trying to get away from, so aversion. When there's pleasant feeling, the default is trying to get more of it, so that's attraction. Neither painful nor pleasant feeling. The default is the delusion, but or the wanting it to be more interesting, wanting it to be pleasant or unpleasant. So there's that ordinary contemplation of the different types of feelings, and so I think like I'm feeling tired right now, and that's slightly unpleasant, so I want to get away from that. I want to go rest, go to sleep, but then the samana way is to contemplate that and not be so swayed by it. Or I'm thinking like seeing people making these rag monkeys earlier. That was pleasant feeling, so seeing those rag monkeys hanging outside, and I wanted more of that. I wanted to make one myself. So that's because it's pleasant. And for anyone who wants to make rag monkeys, you can find it on YouTube, how to make them. It's a cool technique. So there's this idea that Thai New Year is coming as well. So the time keeps moving on, things keep changing. So how do we relate to that? And the Buddha's teaching points to a way of relating to these things in a way that leads toward liberation and freedom from suffering. So using the conditioned world, contemplating it, using it for the cultivation of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feeling. Mindfulness is the path to the deathless. Something as ordinary as just mindfulness and awareness, sati sampajanya, something that ordinary can lead to the element of that which is beyond death. So that's wonderful, that's amazing. And it really takes faith, though. It takes faith that kind of thing is that's possible. The Buddha also distilled the Noble Eightfold Path into Sila Samadhi Panya. So that's the virtue, the meditation or mental clarity, the wisdom. And Sila, the first part of that, is accomplished through faith. The faith isn't yet confirmed because we don't, when we first keep precepts, we don't really know how beneficial they're going to be. So take the five precepts, for example, for lay people. Not taking the life of any living being, not taking that which is not given, and so on. So we don't really know for sure that that's going to be of benefit. Not lying, we don't know for sure that that's going to be a benefit. We might still think internally, we might still deep inside believe that lying sometimes is right, and sometimes we think lying sometimes might have some sort of benefit because we might have seen some immediate benefit from it in the past. We may have gotten away with something or whatever, so we might see that it has some sort of immediate benefit. So that's why sila is accomplished by faith. Sila, sattha, sampanno. That's sila is accomplished by faith because we're looking for the long-term benefit. Telling a lie might give us a short-term benefit in that, you know, they don't know what we did or whatever, but it has the long-term drawback of then we have to remember what we said to this person, what we said to that person. We have to protect our story and make sure that it remains hidden. Whereas when we are truthful and honest, even though it might have had a short-term painful feeling, like we may have taken a loss in the short term, but then we gain in the long term, and that we develop a sense of integrity, and we don't have to have that mental burden of trying to hold up this kind of edifice of what we've been telling to people or whatever. So in the end, that fourth precept, the not lying, it becomes less burdensome, and just it takes a huge weight off the heart if we're just free and open. That's the Satchabharami. Not that we have to go around just blurting out all of our deepest, darkest secrets to everybody. That's not really necessary. But we don't have to have that sense of just having to hide things. And we don't have to, with the sila, we also have conduct that we don't really have to worry if people find out about it. I remember getting this, like, there's these scam emails that come in, and the scam emails, they get more and more tricky. Like, sometimes they find really creative ways to try to get you. And I got this email one time, and it said, you have to contact this site because there's sensitive and embarrassing information that's about to come out about you that's going to be made public. And I thought, oh no, I better click on this because, and then I thought about it for a minute, and I thought, there's nothing that could be made public that I really care about. Who can? Well, they can go ahead and do it if they want. And then I realized what it was. But there was that moment where I almost thought, oh no, I better protect myself. So with the sila, there's that clarity of conduct. Well, yeah, I don't. Even if somebody was going to say the worst thing they possibly could about me, I don't care. So that takes faith at first, but then over time it gets confirmed. So that's the confirmed faith, that confirmed confidence, and then it perhaps gets easier after that. There's a really strong sense that you're on the right path, doing the right thing. The second part, the samadhi, sometimes, a lot of times, there's a misunderstanding when people first come to Buddhism that samadhi means to stop thinking. So, and you find out that that's definitely not what it's referring to. It's a firm establishing of the mind, so it's experienced as solidity, but not rigid, not a rigid solidity, but it comes back to that sense of confidence. So in that sense, sila and samadhi, they're linked, they go together. And also, it seems to have a quality of, as time goes on, one sign that the samadhi, there's a baseline samadhi that we'll have in our daily life. So there's samadhi in terms of meditative absorption that we talk about and get excited about. And that's in the formal meditation, the absorptions that we talk about. But then there's the baseline samadhi that stays with us all the time, and that's what's really important to look at. And the baseline samadhi is something that we don't take our thoughts and moods and emotions as seriously. They no longer have the same power or sway over us, so we're starting to become liberated from them. And that comes from, yes, we do need the formal practice, the sitting and walking meditation, and that's very important for strengthening that baseline samadhi. But then throughout the day, how are we acting? How are we reacting? What's the mind doing? That's really going to highlight the strength of the baseline samadhi. Yeah. So when a thought or a mood arises, it has much less sway, much less power. And it also goes part and parcel with mindfulness. Mindfulness and samadhi are really linked together. With the samadhi, the mindfulness starts to have more power. As the mindfulness has more power, then the samadhi starts to become more stable in terms of just that threshold or that baseline. And then whatever mental proliferation might arise, we see it in a more detached way with mindfulness. And when a mood arises, we are able to see it in a more detached way with mindfulness. And that's really important because that leads to that sense of power in the practice. We realize what's truly important. It isn't the content of our ideas or the stories we tell ourselves. What's important is the path, and the mindfulness itself is what's important. The samadhi itself is what's important. So we develop these ways of always coming back to that. And then the panya, that also goes with that, because the panya is linked with that contemplation of anicca, or trying to see anicca in all things. When we see the anicca of our moods and emotions and our thoughts, then that really gives them much less power. when we come back to mindfulness of feeling, also that highlights the root defilements of attraction, aversion, and delusion. Attraction being the default option in reaction to pleasant feeling, aversion being the default reaction to unpleasant feeling, and so on. And those root defilements start to lose power because of seeing just the impermanent nature and how these things are constantly arising and passing away. And so it starts to become more like just this constant flow of feeling seen with mindfulness. And the default reactions that got us to trouble in the past, they no longer, in a way, we were empowering those moods and emotions and those feelings by those reactions. So if we have some sort of negative mental proliferation towards somebody else, say as an example, some sort of critical some critical thoughts of somebody else, then acting on that or acting from that aversion and then deciding to say something, but it was out of aversion, it wasn't out of, say, that person's well-being. Say this is just a hypothetical example, then that really empowers that mood or emotion, and we've been controlled by it, so we acted on it instead of seeing it with mindfulness. Mindfulness is like the brakes that stops us from acting in ways which might do harm to ourselves and others. We stop and reflect, take time, consider. Mindfulness and clear awareness, sati sampajanya, that's also taking time and considering what we're doing, taking time and considering what we're saying, taking time and considering how we're acting, taking time and considering how we're using our mind, our thought process. It's not saying we're trying to stop the thought process, but we're reflecting on it and trying to see it more clearly, see the impermanent nature of it. One way also to contemplate anicca is to bring it back to aging. And one way to do this is to think that all Dhamma practitioners of the past, all people of the past, were our age at some point. If they made it to our age, if they didn't pass away before they got to our age, then they, all people who have already passed away, were our age at some point, having similar types of experiences. So it's always been the same. It's throughout history, these human truths haven't changed at all. Externally, things have changed and become more comfortable at times, or perhaps even less comfortable at times, depending on the time in history, but the human suffering and the impermanence, the truths of impermanence, have been the same. So we can think about that and reflect on it, that we have this opportunity, and we make much of this opportunity that we have in coming into contact with the Buddha's teachings and with these ideas that help to free us from always being it helps to free us from having to follow along with the moods and emotions and the feelings, and allows us to reflect on them with mindfulness. That's really what our life is here, is that ordinary reflecting and considering with mindfulness, and therefore bolstering up the sila samadhi panya, especially focusing on that threshold samadhi, that base level samadhi that we're going to have all the time, slowly goes up based on the mindfulness and clear awareness, but it's a very slow progress, so we can become disheartened sometimes. And that's when we have to cultivate qualities like Kanti Bharami, patient endurance. If we need to inspire ourselves, then we can inspire ourselves with acts of kindness, acts of generosity. That's a quick, easy way to brighten the heart. And a lot of people here have already had insight into that. So generosity, Dana Bharami, that just becomes a way of life, a way of being that is conducive to well-being and happiness. There's all these different ways of practice. So that's about all that I have for this evening. I'll leave it there. Chant on page 33, verses of sharing inspiration.